Do we have counsel here for the final case, the Melrose Federation of Teachers case? Okay, you may approach the well. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, April 8th, 2025. We have six cases on our calendar today for us set for oral argument. This is the fourth case. This is A24-1813, Melrose Federation of Teachers, American Federation of Teachers Local 1284 versus Melrose Independent School District number 740. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant after that, if you so choose. This proceeding is being live streamed. It is also being recorded, and an oral recording will be available to the parties after. And I just want to confirm, there are two counsel on respondents table. Will we be hearing arguments from both or just one?
Just one today.
Okay, thank you. When you approach the podium, you can lower and adjust it. There's a button underneath. There's also a timer up there indicating how much time you have. Please be aware of that and try to stay within the time limits. And you can also adjust the microphone so we can hear you clearly for the recording. With that, counsel, you may proceed and introduce yourself and the party you're representing.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. So my name is Jonathan Reiner. I am counsel for the Melrose Federation of Teachers. So today, the legal issue before the court is whether a court or an arbitrator decides the arbitrability in a grievance case. The plain language of the Minnesota Uniform Arbitration Act, MUAA, could not be more clear that an arbitrator must decide arbitrability in this case and not a court. There are only two types of arbitrability, procedural and substantive. The MUAA has a different rule for each type over who has jurisdiction, a court or an arbitrator. So procedural arbitrability, that's the first kind. That's whether the parties followed the rules in their agreement to get the matter to arbitration. The MUAA states that arbitrators decide issues of procedural arbitrability in all types of contractual disputes. Commercial contracts, collective bargaining agreements, in all of those settings, arbitrators decide issues of procedural arbitrability. Substantive arbitrability, the only other kind, is whether the agreement between the parties covers the dispute. Is this a claim that's covered by the contract? The MUAA says courts decide substantive arbitrability issues except in the case of a grievance arising under a CBA, when an arbitrator shall decide. Minnesota is the only state to, oh, yes.
Counsel, it seems to me an important consideration in deciding the legal issue before us is what is the meaning of the term grievance as used in 572B.06 paragraph B?
Absolutely. That's...
I didn't see a lot of argument about that in your brief, but... In your view, is that term ambiguous or unambiguous?
That term is unambiguous, and this court has addressed that issue specifically in the Schauber case.
In that case, though, there wasn't a question. There was no question that there wasn't a grievance because there was a lawsuit that had been filed in district court. So I don't think it resolved what the meaning of the term grievance is.
Mm-hmm.
So you think it's unambiguous. What do you think the meaning then is?
So in dicta in that case, which I agree with, the meaning is a grievance that proceeds to arbitration under the agreement, right? So in this case...
And as you know, both Judge Reyes and I were on the panel in that case, so that is helpful.
Yeah, absolutely, and I think you decided...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, of course, I think you decided that perfectly. That case didn't... That case didn't get into...
Chris wrote the opinion, so...
It's my fault.
I don't get any credit.
Well, there was no need for you to, you know, parse out, you know, whether that was a grievance. Because there was...
So
you're right, there's
in,
no...
In Schauber, what language are you pointing us to, then?
It is... pardon me, I'm going to bring it up here. The quote is, all the Schauber Court would require for the grievance exception to apply in future cases is, quote, a grievance that has been submitted to arbitration until the grievance process is complete. And that is what has happened here. In this case, there's no dispute that the union filed a grievance. There's no dispute that the parties processed.
Well, I think there is a dispute that the union filed a grievance. According to the school district and the district court judge. And then doesn't that lead us to whether we consider the arbitration or the collective bargaining agreement to determine what a grievance is, or do we look somewhere else like to Black's Law Dictionary or another definition?
Ultimately, like the employer has raised here, they say the grievance is not a grievance. That essentially is a substantive arbitrability issue. Is this a dispute that is covered by the contract's grievance procedure? Is this a grievance? Is this something that is arbitrable? That is something that is a substantive arbitrability issue, and the MUAA is clear that arbitrators have jurisdiction over that.
And what language do you think makes that clear?
That will be in 572B.06B. It gets to that issue that you raised, Judge, earlier. It says, except in cases of a grievance arising under a CBA, which modifies the preceding language in that provision, which talks about substantive arbitrability that courts have jurisdiction over, except in the case of a grievance arising under a CBA.
So an arbitrator, if you read the paragraph as a whole, an arbitrator shall decide then whether there is an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. Is that how you read it?
Correct.
And the controversy here seems to me to be retirement benefits, not whether there's a grievance.
Correct.
So wouldn't the court decide then whether there's a grievance? In other words, whether the controversy is subject to an agreement is the controversy is whether the retirement benefits are available under the collective bargaining agreement.
Yeah, and I think the modification to that sentence at the end of except in the case of a grievance arising under a CBA, which there has been here over the controversy of those retirement benefits, then in that case the arbitrator decides.
So are the retirement benefits covered by the CBA? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, there's language in the contract that describes this benefit. It basically says if a teacher teaches in the school district for 15 years and they retire from the district, that's the language in the agreement, they get this benefit. It's like a $600 sum per month that goes to health insurance premiums up until Medicare. So the substantive benefit is in the language of the agreement. The grievance procedure is the only, mechanism other than, filing a suit in court to enforce that language. It's a very efficient process, impartial process. It provides the parties with finality. That's what the union did here. They reviewed the denial of this benefit to this teacher. They determined that the language was violated, and they did, their exclusive remedy of filing a grievance.
Your argument seems to be, to me, that if you fill out the form with the grievance and you send it in, then at that point it has to be decided by an arbitrator. Is it that simple?
Not quite. There's a little more to it. So every grievance procedure is going to have steps, procedures that the grievance has to proceed until it reaches the arbitration level. So in this case, in this contract, step one is like an informal discussion between the parties. Step two is I could bring up the collective bargaining agreement, but they are very similar across contracts where there's then a decision between the manager, like the superintendent, and then it goes to the school board, and then after that, the arbitration level. And it has to go there. There's no arbitrator to decide at step two or step three. The grievance has to proceed all the way to the level of arbitration. And here the parties did that, which was, there's, you know, detailed requirements about how to get that grievance to arbitration. The parties followed every step of that. The union requested a list of arbitrators from the Bureau of Mediation Services, which was required under the contract. And at that point, when I reached out to district counsel to select an arbitrator, that is the first time that the employer refused to arbitrate. They didn't communicate that intent at any step prior to. If they had refused to process the grievance, it would be a different matter. It would be a different case. But we got to that arbitration step, and that's when an arbitrator has full jurisdiction over arbitrability.
And was the grievance form that's in the record at Exhibit 2, was that submitted early in that stage of the steps, or is that submitted at the arbitration stage?
That's submitted at step one or two, I believe. I'm looking at the...
So that's my question, I guess. So once you fill out that form, step one or two, is your position that it automatically needs to go to arbitration at that point?
No, not until it proceeds to the arbitration
step. Right, you've got to go through the other steps. But if it gets to that step, it has to go to arbitration.
Yes.
So there's no discretion, no room for the court to figure out, is this an actual grievance?
No, because that is essentially a substantive arbitrability question that the clear policy of Minnesota. We're not asking the court
to
make that.
I keep talking about the clear policy of Minnesota and it being a substantive question, and I understand that argument, but we have to focus on the language of the statute. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, so help us understand how, whether something is a grievance, how that is an issue that falls within the language of which an arbitrator is to decide, which is whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate.
That's where the legislative history, if you want to call it, around this Uniform Arbitration Act has been really instructive. That language is derived from all of the federal litigation around the Federal Arbitration Act, and that is essentially, and the drafters of this legislation, you know, there's comments about that, and that is in the brief. That is, you know, that language, that usage of that language, whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to that agreement, that is substantive arbitrability. And under the federal law, courts have jurisdiction over that issue to determine whether an agreement, whether something covers a controversy or not. But Minnesota departed from that by adding that language, and it's the only state to have done that.
Do we know why? Is there legislative history to help us understand why?
There is nothing.
The legislature's intent was?
Nothing that I could find, Your Honor. Just the fact that that language was added, and it's very unique, and it's very broad, except in the case of a grievance arising under a CBA. And the Inver Grove Heights case, I think, is also instructive on that. This court did not, you know, define what a grievance was in that case, but they remanded it to the district court to do that application. And the district court's application is good. You know, they did not go as far as to say that every grievance that's submitted to arbitration, you know, is under the jurisdiction of the arbitrator, but they reached that result, and they basically just cited the statutory provision that said all, you know, they cited both the procedural one and the substantive one, and they said, look, arbitrators have jurisdiction completely in a grievance arising under a CBA, and they applied it to those facts and held that the arbitrator had jurisdiction.
Are you basically saying that the district court does not have jurisdiction to decide either the procedural or the substantive issue, and it just under the MUAA, it just has to go, once it reaches the arbitration step, it has to go to arbitration?
Yes, absolutely. For procedural cases, for procedural issues, right, if someone says you didn't follow the steps correctly or if it's untimely, it has to go to arbitration in all contexts, whether that's a commercial dispute or a grievance arising under a CBA. It's only for the grievance cases arising under a CBA that the substantive arbitrability issues also have to go to an arbitrator. Otherwise, a court has jurisdiction.
How do we read that language with Section 572B.07, which talks about if there's a motion to compel arbitration, if the refusing party, the court shall order the parties to arbitrate if the refusing party does not oppose the motion. If the refusing party opposes the motion, the court shall proceed to summarily decide the issue. And unless the court finds there is no enforceable agreement to arbitrate, it shall order the parties to arbitrate. So what does the court have the authority to decide then?
So that provision, it's the general rule with...
Interview, sorry.
Oh, of course. That provision generally authorizes motions to compel arbitration, right? That's how the language begins. And then it says, unless the court finds that there is no enforceable agreement to arbitrate, it shall order the parties to arbitrate. So that is the general rule that once there's a motion to compel arbitration, the court will look and see if there's an agreement to arbitrate. That language is really getting at, is there a contract? Is there an agreement? Because if there isn't, if there's some defense in law or equity for revocation of the contract, the court will decide that.
So the district court only has authority to decide whether or not, like here, there's a collective bargaining agreement.
Correct.
And if it determines there is a CBA, then it has to go to arbitration.
Yeah, the court shall decide summarily to proceed for the parties to arbitrate. That's separate from an arbitrability argument that has been raised. Like 572B.07A has to do with whether there's an agreement at all. And that has never been disputed. The employer has not said that there's not a binding collective bargaining agreement. But then there's a separate issue of what if an employer raises that the grievance is not arbitrable. And that's when you get into 572B.06. And that's what the employer raised when they said this grievance is not a grievance. That is essentially a substantive arbitrability question. And 572B.06B says that arbitrators have jurisdiction over that in grievance cases.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll move now to arguments from counsel for respondent. You'll have 15 minutes. And the clock is set. Please state your name for the record and party you're representing, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Trevor Helmers, and I represent the school district respondent in this case. Let me get this out of the way first. The district also would like to compliment the justices on the Schaber decision. It's not simply the appellant, also respondent, would like to get that little bit in there as well. But to the actual case here, this is a very simple case. The former employee is not covered by the collective bargaining agreement.
Isn't that a substantive issue for the arbitrator to decide?
And I would draw a distinction here between a substantive issue of is the grievance correct? Is the grievance, does this person have some kind of substantive right here? And a different standing issue. This person is not a part of this collective bargaining agreement. They don't
have to look at the collective bargaining agreement to get to that answer.
Correct.
And the statute says that the court shall decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate. So, except in the cases of a grievance arising under collective bargaining agreement, in which case the arbitrator shall decide. So here, what is the meaning of the word grievance?
Yes.
And is it ambiguous or unambiguous?
And I would say that the meaning of the word grievance is unambiguous. A grievance is what the parties in the contract define it to be. And the statutory language to me is clear.
And why do you give it that interpretation as the what it is defined as by the parties?
Because that there isn't a different definition in any of the case law that we have.
Well, and there's a lax law dictionary, and our courts, the Supreme Court has said in our the canons of construction say we are to interpret terms according to their common and ordinary meaning, and if a term is undefined, we can look to a dictionary, including a legal dictionary. So it seems to me it's possible that grievance might have the meaning of Black's Law Dictionary. Or it might have the meaning in the collective bargaining agreement, but I'm trying to understand how best to interpret that term here.
And my argument would be, I understand that point. My argument would be, a grievance means something different in almost every collective bargaining agreement. There is a definite...
Right, and doesn't that seem... I'm kind of struggling with... And I agree with you on that point, because the language in the IGH case was different than the Shaver case, is different than this case. In fact, in the Shaver case, there was a four-step process before you got to arbitration. Here it's a five-step process. So, you know, just speaking for myself, I tend to agree with you there, but I have a more fundamental question is, do we even get to the question of what is the definition of grievance? Because when I look at the MUAA section 572B.06B, the language says, quote, the court shall decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate, except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, when an arbitrator shall decide. My first question for you is that language ambiguous or not?
And my argument would be no. Okay. That's not ambiguous.
Okay. So if that language is not ambiguous, then we just look at the plain language, which, with all due respect to opposing counsel, then we don't need to get into the legislative history, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Because that language, and I think both parties agree, is unambiguous, but it's kind of worded backwards. Let me know if you agree with this. Do you think that language can be read to mean, in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, the arbitrator shall decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists or a controversy is subject to an agreement to arbitrate? And I'm basically just kind of taking the same language but flipping around. Is that a fair characterization of that language?
I think that probably is a fair characterization. It's not the way it was written, but that seems to be a fair characterization, which still gives us the fundamental issue of when it is not a grievance. And here, I think the issue really is, at every stage, the district said, this is not a grievance. This person is not a part of this bargaining unit.
Right, but that gets to the substantive issue of what is a grievance? What is a teacher? What is, and so aren't those issues really for the arbitrator? Because here we have a situation in which the parties went through all four steps of the process, now reached the step in which it would normally go to an arbitrator. School district objected to that and said, no, we don't think so, but which led appellants to file the motion to compel. And that's another reason why I think this is different than Shaver. And there, the process stopped. There was no arbitration. In IGH, there was a dual arbitration and litigation. Here, all there is the stalled arbitration process, the grievance process under the collective bargaining agreement, and a motion to compel. So isn't the district court's decision limited to solely whether, let me make sure I get the language right here, whether there's an agreement in place, whether there's a collective bargaining agreement in place, and if there is, then it should go to the arbitrator?
Yes, and I think that this... this kind of hits on one of the distinctions here and the difference between 572B07 and 572B06. This is a motion to compel, so you have to start with 572B07. And that is the case, and so that's why we don't get to this idea of you get to skip right past what a grievance is, and you get to skip past, and just because the district, just because the union raised it, means that that somehow has to go through that process.
But 07, doesn't that just, where does that give the district court the authority to to decide whether or not it's a grievance. Doesn't that just say the district court has to decide whether or not there is an agreement in place that covers the parties?
An enforceable agreement to arbitrate, yes.
Right. And if there is an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, which is not disputed, then why doesn't it just go then to the arbitrator to decide the substantive issues?
And I would say in normal course it would. There is absolutely a dispute over whether there is an agreement on the parties to arbitrate as opposed to retired or non-employees.
But you have a collective bargaining agreement with the teachers union that includes an arbitration provision.
Correct.
So isn't there an agreement, an enforceable agreement to arbitrate? Whether this is a grievance that falls within that is a different question, but there is an agreement to arbitrate with the union. Isn't that accurate?
That is correct.
So why doesn't that answer the question in 07? And then as Judge Reyes has been asking, then why isn't the question of whether there is a grievance that is within the scope of the arbitration agreement a controversy that the arbitrator decides under 06?
And my argument would be because it is not a grievance. Yes, there is a collective bargaining agreement.
Whether it's a grievance or not, is determined by the CBA, according to you, so that requires some legal interpretation. We don't say there is or isn't a grievance. I mean, the parties are arguing about that, so I don't think the answer that there isn't a grievance is satisfying to me anyway.
And I think that this gets to the question of what is the district court's role, what is the district court's responsibility? And I think that the way that this was written, with these two statutes read together, there has to be some ability for the district court to look at the agreement. First of all, to decide whether it's arbitrable, and whether then the second factor on whether the dispute falls within the scope of the arbitration agreement. That case law on, 572B07 hasn't been overturned about what you look at on a motion to compel.
But it predates this language about, except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement.
But it has continued to be cited since then as well. And we don't have...
In this specific situation?
No, we do not have any cases. This is truly a case of first impression on how to look at this. And I know that we've talked a couple of times about the Invergrove Heights case. The Invergrove Heights case just simply cited to the statute. Every other case that we have on it just simply cited to the statute. And even in the Invergrove Heights case, when it went back to the district court, the district court had to look at the collective bargaining agreement and say, this is a grievance. That was not in dispute there, but that is in that decision, which is in document, I think, 7 in the record. It was cited by appellant here. So you can look that even in that case, the district court has to look at it. And I would argue that it's really something different than substantive arbitrability, which is, does this... is there merit to this claim? It's almost like a standing issue.
Are you talking about, just for clarification, when you're talking about the IGH case, are you talking about after it had been reversed back down to the district court?
Yes.
In that case, there is no appeal from that district court decision, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So
it went to arbitration.
Okay. Thank you.
And in that case, I'll just cite it. Broadly speaking, the union's claim constitutes a grievance under the CBA. They had to make that decision. They had to look at the information to be able to make that determination. And I think the issue that I want to highlight as well is something that Judge Schmidt brought up. If we're on this issue of what is a grievance, the question was, if you fill out a form, does that mean that it's automatically a grievance? And this brings to mind the question that the district court judge asked in the oral arguments on this case, which was, what if John or Bob, I can't remember which name, what if Bob from the hardware store has the union file a grievance on his behalf on the contract? Does that automatically have to go to arbitration simply because the union wrote it? And the argument from the union today, from appellant, would be yes, that you don't get to look at that a court doesn't get to use common sense, doesn't get to look at the contract itself. You just have to say, well, you filed the forms, you cited the right forms, you got here, this has to go to grievance arbitration.
But then even if that's the process, the arbitrator can still decide, you know what, this teacher doesn't have standing because the teacher retired. It's not a proper grievance. The union is not the proper party. So the arbitrator can still decide those substantive issues, correct?
You're absolutely correct.
Okay. And I want to go back to 572B.07B. And when I'm looking at the language, I'm looking at the second sentence, and it says, quote, if the court finds that there is an enforceable agreement to arbitrate, it shall order the parties to arbitrate. It doesn't, it seems like the district court's authority is very, very limited in scope by that statute. That's the district court just looks at whether or not there's an enforceable agreement to arbitrate. There's a collective bargaining agreement. The collective bargaining agreement has an arbitration provision between the parties, and if that's the finding by the court, then it shall order the parties to arbitrate. So maybe I'm looking at this too simplistically, but it seems like that controls, and that's why the motion to compel arbitration is met here. What am I missing from that analysis?
Yeah, and I think that that is a part of the analysis. The language says that if there's no enforceable agreement to arbitrate, if there is an enforceable agreement, if there's no enforceable agreement, you don't order the parties to arbitrate. And I think as a part of that enforceable agreement, you have to be able to look at standing in addition to just substantive.
Where does it say in the statute, though? Where does it say that the district court also has to look at whether the parties have standing?
Well, I think that's part and parcel to an enforceable agreement. There is no enforceable agreement in this case. Yes, we have an agreement with the union.
The grievance was filed by the school district, and they have an agreement. I mean, not the school district, the Teachers Federation, and they have an agreement with the school district.
Correct. However, there has to be a teacher in order to be a proper grievance. And there was no.
The question is whether there's an enforceable agreement to arbitrate.
Not with people who aren't teachers. It has to be the definition of grievance talks about how there has to be a teacher involved. The union has no right on its own to file a grievance on its own. It has to be connected.
You're suggesting that 572B.07 allows the court to look at more than whether there's just an enforceable agreement to arbitrate between the union and the school district. And is that right?
Well, I would argue that, yeah, that's part and parcel to whether there's an enforceable agreement is, are these parties in front of me, are they subject to an enforceable agreement? And here, that's not the case, because the party that's in front of you, and I see my time has run out, if I may be allowed to finalize, the parties here truly are the former employee and the district. That's the person, because a grievance is defined as a teacher. There is no teacher who has filed a grievance.
Can be brought by a group of teachers under the...
Correct.
And isn't the union a group of teachers?
The union is not a group of teachers. A group of teachers would be employees, because teachers are defined as employees. The union is not an employee. So in order for the union can absolutely represent teachers or groups of teachers at every stage. That is not the facts of this case. That is not what happened here.
The union, I'm sorry, did you say the union can represent a teacher or a group of teachers?
Correct.
Okay. And correct. But doesn't allow for, I know we're getting now into the substantive of this, the CBA, but isn't there a provision for representation for a teacher or teachers?
Correct.
Okay.
And one of the requirements for a proper grievance is they have to be named. Here, the only individual that was named was a former teacher who was not subject.
Past protocol, usually unions bring grievances, correct?
Unions are the ones that would technically file them, but they have no right to bring them on their own. It has to be a teacher or a group of teachers to file a grievance, as these parties have defined it in this collective bargaining agreement.
So in your view, a retiree could never bring a grievance, even if they were denied all their retirement benefits?
In this case, no. In other cases, absolutely. If the parties negotiate for that, there's case law that we cited in our briefing that talked about times, and that the appellant cited in their briefing that talked about times when the parties have said that retirees, former employees, can absolutely follow through and file a grievance on these things.
I'm a teacher. I'm retired now, and I have benefits under the collective bargaining agreement. So you're saying that under your reading, I would have no recourse to have those retiree benefits for me to enforce those retiree benefits under the collective bargaining agreement?
What I'm saying is you wouldn't have the recourse under the grievance and arbitration language of the collective bargaining agreement. You can absolutely file a lawsuit on a breach of contract. You can absolutely enforce those claims, but it is not a grievance as these parties have defined it because it doesn't include a teacher, which is defined as an employee, not a former employee. So under this contract, no, you cannot bring a grievance arbitration. You have other opportunities and other avenues to attempt to get those same rights.
So I wasn't on that other case, and so no credit to me. But my question is about how narrowly you construe the form with the grievance. So it seems to me, the name of the grievance here is the union. It's talking about a specific teacher, but then as the process progressed, including in the district court, the union was clear that this is about more than just the teacher, that this is about the active teacher's rights. So why doesn't that then, if we are looking at the language of the grievance and needing an active teacher, why doesn't that put us into arbitration?
Yes, and I believe that was kind of an argument that was first raised at the district court, that was never written in any of the documentation. The first time they said, well, this is actually on behalf of everybody, was at the district court, and the district court saw through that and said, no, you're way too late to go back and try to change your grievance now, because the grievance language requires notice within 20 days, so that they couldn't go back and change it.
They're stuck with the form that gets filed, even if they're saying this is not an exclusive remedy as the redress sought?
Correct.
And what case says that you're stuck with that form, that you can't?
The contract language that requires that they give notice of what the grievance is and what redress they're seeking within 20 days.
So let's say the grievance said this same teacher was denied retirement benefits by the district, and that decision affects the rights of all current and former teachers, including the teachers of their considerations if they want to retire. At that point, would the district say, all right, that includes everybody, so off to arbitration we go?
Well, I think that, yeah, we're talking about a different case with different facts, but yeah, in that situation, if you'd named even one teacher, yeah, we'd be in arbitration right now. Say that this teacher's thinking about retiring in a couple of years and wants to know what their rights are under the contract. Or, I mean, the other thing to think about here is this could all be negotiated at the bargaining table, and this could absolutely be cleared up by the parties themselves deciding this, instead of coming to the courts and asking for this court to expand definitions and to say, well, now it's not just teachers that can file.
They're asking the court to expand the definition, and maybe you're arguing that because of this point about the group of teachers, but really the issue before us is to who is to decide the arbitrability, or whether this grievance is properly, whether the district court properly decided that there wasn't a grievance to be arbitrated, or whether an arbitrator should decide that. Isn't that the key issue before us here?
Yes, I think it is. And a part of that decision is that on a motion to compel, the district court decides whether there is a case or controversy. And then the district court should be able to decide, because it's a motion to compel, whether this is a grievance. That's how I would say that those two, you would harmonize the two statutes on a motion to compel.
Where is that grievance language in 570B.07 that the district court can decide whether or not there is a grievance?
I think that has to be read together. You read that together with 572B06, which says that it's always in the courts unless it's a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement, and then there is a motion to compel brought, and so the court has to look at both of those issues.
But that's doesn't 572B06B say that arbitrator is to decide whether an agreement to arbitrate exists in the case of a collective bargaining agreement? That's where I think it's hard to sort of reconcile 07 and 06.
I agree, and it's when there is a grievance, specifically when there is a grievance. And so in the first instance, our point would be that on a motion to compel, the way that you read these two together is that the district court has to make that decision. The district court can't just say, well, yeah, that's part and parcel to, is there an enforceable agreement here? Is there a grievance here? That's really the only way to read them together, which is what the Invergrove Heights District Court did here. Which, when we're talking about that Invergrove Heights case, they said, yeah, there is a grievance here, so we're sending it back.
That's the district court proceeding, which is not binding
Correct.
On this court.
Correct. Yep, because as I mentioned, this really is a case of first impression.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, for respondent, you will have, we did go overtime. We went about 8 minutes overtime. If you do, why don't we set the clock for 12 minutes for rebuttal. I'm not saying you have to use the extra time, but I just want to give you a little bit extra leeway because there was quite a bit of discussion and good conversation there. So with that, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Yeah, just a few things. The hypothetical about Bob from the hardware store, it's effective. It's absurd because technically, yes, if the union advanced Bob's grievance to the arbitration stage, assuming they did that, an arbitrator has to decide whether that grievance is arbitrable under the MUAA. The union would never do that. The union has limited resources. The union has a duty of fair representation to
what
its members.
What about respondents' argument that having a grievance, that the existence of a grievance is really akin to standing, and the district court needs to decide that to determine whether or not this provision applies?
I don't see standing mentioned anywhere in the MUAA or the case law that interprets it.
Well, but, I mean, the argument is that to determine whether the exception for, except in the case of a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement when an arbitrator shall decide, to determine whether that language applies, you need to know whether there's a grievance, and so it's the role of the district court to make that initial determination. And then the arbitrator decides the existence of the grievance or the agreement to arbitrate and whether the controversy that's being, if there is a grievance, whether the controversy that's being raised is subject to the agreement. I think that's the argument.
And I think, you know, I hate to go back to it again, but again, the Shaver case did it exactly right. All that needs to happen is there needs to be a factual determination that there was a grievance that proceeded to the arbitration level, and the inquiry ends there. It goes to the arbitrator. And Judge Reyes, like you said, all of these things, standing, is this a teacher, all those things can still be decided by an arbitrator, right? An arbitrator could rule against the union. They could rule in favor. But the arbitrator is the one that has expertise to interpret in the law of the shop whether this is actually a grievance or not. I think it's also important to look at 572B.04, which gives parties the express right to alter their agreement. They can change the default rules of the MUAA. They can say that a court should decide substantive arbitrability. The parties did not do that here. The parties have not altered any of the requirements of the MUAA, and I think that's an important distinction. There was also some discussion about whether the union can be a party to a grievance. The party's bargaining history and labor history here has shown that the union has done that. In Doc ID number 8 at 72, there was a grievance filed by the exclusive rep. The Melrose Federation of Teachers was the named grievant that went to arbitration. There was an arbitration decision. There was never any claim at any stage that grievance was not arbitrable. And if the judges have any further questions.
That a union is not a group of teachers for purposes of the CBA here?
I would disagree.
But I think the definition of teacher is someone who's employed by the district. So how is the union a group of teachers?
In the broader sense, an exclusive representative, they are, based on their freedoms of association, they are a group. A union is a concerted group. It's a more than one type thing. But the essence of that question, it's a substantive arbitrability question. Is the union a group of teachers? Does this contract cover this dispute filed by this, exclusive rep? That is something that's decided by the arbitrator, according to the MUAA.
If we are digging into the language of grievance, what is your take on the form being controlling and strictly read?
What do you mean exactly, the form?
Well, so the district court here said you could have brought a claim on behalf of all members of the union, but you didn't. And that's based on the reading of the form where it says this teacher was denied benefits and the redress sought is the grievant be made whole. I tend to think that the decision has greater ramifications than for this teacher. Whether any teacher can ever work in retirement seems to be a question that if you get into the merits. But the what the district court in its analysis and what the forum seems to support is this is very narrow to just this person and not to all other current and former teachers.
And again, that is a question of substantive arbitrability that an arbitrator decides. Yeah, the take that I have, I don't want to give away too much, until we get to arbitration, right? Like, that's what we'll have to, raise there. That is the forum where that is decided.
So, but let's say we get past that idea of, like, now we're into your opponent's argument that we are interpreting what grievance means, and we're dealing with, all right, is this a grievance that's valid that can go forward? Do we have to interpret the form that narrowly to say this is only about this one teacher?
And an arbitrator has to make that interpretation. They have to, if the form comes in as an issue of whether this is a grievance or not, that is a substantive arbitrability question.
Okay, but I'm trying to say, all right, now we're past that. We're saying a court makes that determination of whether this is a valid grievance or not. How do we evaluate the form at that point to say, like, all right, now I'm looking at your form and determining whether this is a grievance on behalf of just this retired teacher, or we're looking at this is a grievance that includes all current teachers?
So the question is then, is that a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement?
And how narrowly do we interpret? Like, I'm at this grievance in Exhibit 2, teacher was denied retirement benefits by the district. You could have included language, which is what the district court apparently said, is which affects the rights of all current teachers. How broadly or narrowly would we interpret the form itself?
Quite broadly. Yeah, quite broadly.
And based on what?
Based on the language in the MUAA, it's very simple. It just says a grievance arising under a collective bargaining agreement. The form is a grievance. It was filed by the union. That meets the standard in the statutory language. If there are no further questions, I rest. So thank you.
Thank you both, counsel, for the briefing and for the oral arguments. We really appreciate it, and we realize we did go over, but we had some questions, and we appreciate you taking the time to answer all those questions. The case is submitted. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. That is our final oral argument, so the court is now in recess to conference on the cases. Thank you all.